Today's Taisho will be on Bodhidharma's Mind Pacifying, Case 41 in the Mumonkan. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind." "Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you," replied Bodhidharma. "I have searched for my mind and cannot take hold of it," said the second patriarch. "Your mind is now pacified," said Bodhidharma. Comments: that broken-toothed old Hindu came so importantly thousands of miles over the sea. He was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Why, Shisanro did not know four ideographs. Coming east, directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma and trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you. I'm glad everybody could make it here today, this morning. Probably your lives are very busy. You probably have many details that have to be wrapped up, especially if you're in education. You have to get your papers done and your grades in, and there are many pressing details. If you're not in education, you still have a lot to do, I'm sure. And sometimes things don't go as planned. You can make very careful plans, but sometimes they just don't work out. And often when this happens, we can become agitated and fearful. One of the interesting things is that life doesn't really have life isn't really as controllable as we'd like. And as we move forward as we grow up and as we move forward into our work and our responsibilities, it can be a little frightening because we suddenly realize how much depends on factors beyond our control. So right now, some people have lost their jobs in the current economy. They might have done very good work. You know, they might have really been excellent at their jobs, but maybe their company gets into trouble. Nothing they did. It's possible also that a friend of mine. Just went to the doctor for a recent visit, just like a routine visit, and they found a lump in her neck, you know. So these things can happen to people, and when they happen, they're quite frightening sometimes. We plan, and life sometimes just won't do what we want it to do. And when that happens, it can be very unnerving. I often think that in this koan, we're looking at a case of somebody who has lost his trust in life. The man who goes to see Bodhidharma, sitting in a cave, has heard about Bodhidharma somewhere. You might know the story of Bodhidharma. He came from India, probably South India, and he went to China. And when he came to China, he was a famous meditation master, and he was given an interview with Emperor Wu of Liang. And Emperor Wu was very devout Buddhist. He was building temples and libraries and other facilities all over China. And he wanted to meet this famous meditation master. So this was like a very great opportunity for Bodhidharma to impress the emperor. And if he impresses the emperor well enough, he will be able to have a temple and all the things he wants. But the interview doesn't go well at all because the emperor asks Bodhidharma. He says basically, "I've built many temples and convents and other religious facilities. How much merit have I acquired?" And Bodhidharma says, "No merit." He said, "I've done all these good deeds. How much good karma have I stored up?" And Bodhidharma says, "No good karma." The emperor is taken aback, you know. And he says, "You know, who are you?" And Bodhidharma says, "I'm not sure. I don't know." Actually, what he says, "I don't know." And then, he says, "Well, what do you practice? You know, don't you practice the way of great holiness?" And Bodhidharma says, "Not great holiness, great emptiness." And after that, Bodhidharma leaves, and he goes up into the mountains. And he sits in a cave for 9 years, waiting for some students to show up. So, I mean, Bodhidharma is somebody, I think, who has great trust in life. This is, I think, quite difficult sometimes to preserve, you know. If Bodhidharma had been a less trusting person, he probably wouldn't have gone to China. He was well regarded in India, and he was respected and thought of as a great, deeply awakened person. So he had it all made in the shade, as they say. You know, he could have gone to any temple in India and been a well-received and honored guest. But instead he goes to China, which is really like a wild card. My own teacher, Genki Roshi, went to the United States in his 40s. And I always think about that. I often think, what that took a lot of courage for somebody who was not a very good speaker of English to pick up and come to the United States in his 40s. And so he went to a foreign country, a strange place. He had no real safety net. So Webb, my other teacher, had invited him to come to the United States, and Genki Roshi came. And basically he had very little money. You know, he had very no life insurance policy, I think. I don't think so. But he came, and he started the Seattle Zen Center. And at that time, we weren't in very good financial shape ourselves. So, it wasn't as though we had a lot of money and security to offer Genki. But he had trust somehow. He had some kind of trust. And I think that's really remarkable, you know. When I was with him, I would feel much calmer. You know, he somehow exuded a deep sense of calm. And a deep sense of trust. You know? And there was something about him, I don't know how to put my finger on it, but just being with him was very reassuring to me. So I studied with Genki for many years. And even though I saw him get upset sometimes people would just do things that ticked him off, you know. He always had this extraordinary sense of humor, and kind of like nothing ever seemed to throw him, to make him, you know, sometimes in life things happen to us that knock us off our feet. And we can become like hysterically anxious about it. And we feel helpless and like we're drifting, or like we're losing control. And when people get like that, they can get very aggressive, or they can get very, they can be paralyzed, or they can get very depressed. But Genki Roshi always seemed to have his feet firmly on the ground. Mm-hmm. There was something about his way of living that was very rooted, very anchored. And, you know, interestingly, when Nyogen Senzaki died, his final words to his students were, "Keep your head cool and your feet warm." And I think that's very good advice. You know, don't let your head get overheated, but keep your feet, you know, your foundation warm. Something about Genki was warm like that. He seemed to be able to, I think many, many, many years of Zazen had given him this deep sense of connection to things. And if you connect with things long enough, you know, Zen is really not just about emptiness. On the other side of emptiness, there's this deep sense of connectedness. And if you stay with that sense of connectedness long enough, you know, you begin to develop this unflappable, indestructible trust. And Genki had that, really and truly. It was quite amazing and wonderful. And Bodhidharma had that too. You know, he came from India to a strange place, and went to this interview with Emperor Wu of Liang, and completely bombed out. You know, completely, it was like a disaster. You know, the truth is that many people in a situation like that would be devastated, right? You know, you have a big meeting, you've got to make a presentation, a lot's riding on it, and when you give the presentation, it just falls apart, you know. And that could happen to anybody, but it happened to Bodhidharma. But he just calmly left, and he went up into the mountains, and there, that's where he started his life again. And basically, he sat there for 9 years waiting for people to show up. And one day, a person did show up, his first student. And his first student was an interesting person. He was very well-educated and had exquisite knowledge of the traditions of his society. He knew the Confucian classics and Taoism, calligrapher, all of the arts. But nothing gave him that sense of trust. Everything he tried seemed to be give him that sense that he could let go and wouldn't fall, you know. And it's the more you worry about life, you know, the more dangerous and perilous it all becomes. The more you doubt life, the more doubtable it becomes. You know, the more questionable it becomes. The more it's like you can see the possibilities for things going wrong if you look. So at any rate, Bodhidharma went up into the mountains and sat in a cave And the local people brought him food. They heard that this holy man was living in a cave. And they brought him food, and so he survived somehow. And one day the very educated gentleman showed up. And when Bodhidharma saw this guy outside his cave, you'd think he would go, "Oh, thank you, I'm so glad somebody's shown up." But instead he seems totally uninterested in the person. And the student doesn't understand because, you know, a teacher is supposed to be looking for a student. And you can't be a teacher without a student. So he doesn't understand why Bodhidharma doesn't say, "Oh, I'm so glad you're here, come on in." Bodhidharma doesn't welcome him in. And of course, this makes this man even more nervous, right? Even more frightened, because already he's gone out on a limb, right? Maybe he heard about this Zen teacher living up in the mountains named Bodhidharma, and he thought, "Well, I'll take a chance. I'll go up there. You know, otherwise, I'm probably going to just blow out my brains." And he goes up thinking, "This guy's going to help me. This guy's going to help me. This guy's going to help me." But he gets up there, and in fact, Bodhidharma rejects him. Now, rejection is really quite important because we're all afraid of being rejected. You know, we're all afraid of being rejected. And that fear is so great that, it can keep us up at night. At any rate, Bodhidharma doesn't welcome him. But he can't leave. He doesn't have anywhere else to go, really. He's got this desperate sense of uncertainty or uneasiness. And it's pounding inside him, this fear. So he can't go. But he's not welcome, but he can't go. So he sits outside in the snow. It starts to snow and the snow builds up and he's just sitting there in misery. And in the koan it says he finally cuts off his arm to show Bodhidharma that he's devoted. And Bodhidharma says to him, "You didn't have to cut off your arm. "You don't have to cut your arm. I'm only looking for somebody who won't be swayed by others." And then the man says to Bodhidharma, "Listen, my mind is on fire with anxiety. Can you calm my mind?" And Bodhidharma says, basically, find your mind. Find it. Look inside yourself and find your mind. And when Bodhidharma looks to find his mind, the young man looks to find his mind, he encounters mushin. He encounters emptiness. And when he encounters emptiness, his fear and his nervousness, his fear, his lack of trust dissolves. And he is... He is set free. He enters this beautiful, deep, imperturbable calm. Maybe for the first time in his life. You know, people come in here on Wednesday night, and they sit down on the cushion, and their minds are busy, 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 busy all the time. You know, like buzzing, 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 buzzing. They get off the cushion and I say, "How do you feel?" And they often say, "Oh, I'm very relaxed. I feel much more relaxed." They sometimes don't even find mu. But just being quiet and sitting still is deeply restful and relaxing. Sometimes, though, people do actually find mood. It doesn't usually happen to beginners. But sooner or later, people begin to notice that their minds are going blank. I can remember when my mind started to go blank. I can remember the time I discovered it. I was sitting on my own and I suddenly fell into like this blankness, and it was quite dramatic. I mean, I thought, what is that? And afterwards I felt very good, very calm. So anyway, Bodhidharma says, look in your mind and tell me where it is. And the young man, I shouldn't call him a monk, he's not a monk yet, looks in his mind and he falls into this blankness and he's suddenly serene. And this is the beginning of his liberation. This is really very important teaching. In our lives, a lot of social life is about being present for others and doing what they expect of us. You know, and we're constantly worried about how other people will perceive us. This can be very good in a way because we strive to be better and we have relationships with others, you know, so we definitely can't ignore other people and their needs and expectations. But if we worry too much about how we come across, how we appear to others, or even how we appear to ourselves, you know, we can begin to be undermined, you know, lose our confidence. Confidence is very difficult to acquire. I was reading this book, and it was talking about how many young kids have been taught to have more self-confidence by being praised. And so parents will go, oh, you've done such a good job, you know, that's so good, you know, you're a very smart boy, you know, you're very... And apparently it doesn't do any good at all. but the studies show, actually this doesn't do any good. First of all, sometimes people know they aren't doing a good job, they're not really trying, and when they get complimented, it seems disingenuous, right? It just seems like baloney. And of course, if you're berating people, that doesn't give them confidence either. I think people acquire confidence by trying things, and sometimes we fail, but then if we come back and we try it again and it works, we begin to have a confidence. And we sort of realize we can kind of trust. We can sort of trust things a little bit. And it's difficult to have that trust, but if you try something and you fail, then you get frightened. But if you try again, sooner or later, you know, it's like the world is going to hold you up. It's like you begin to realize, I can do this. And you realize I'm not really doing this. You know, I tried one time and it didn't work. I tried again and it worked. It's not as though I made it happen, you know? It just happened. Something clicks, something works, and it's beyond our power, but it happens. And this is, I think, quite important. This is really like the secret of developing trust. You have to keep going until something starts. It's like energy begins to collect. Something starts working for you, you know? And you have to have enough patience and enough trust to go through the periods where things don't work. But you keep going, and finally things begin to sort of, it's like there's a kind of energy that builds up. And it becomes very sustaining, very preserving. When things are not going well, people sometimes become paralyzed, but that's the wrong response, you know. You have to keep trying, and little by little, something begins to respond. So, at any rate, this young man doesn't know this. He's tried everything, and the more he knows, sort of the more uneasy and unhappy he feels, because he has this lack of trust. And so he hears about Bodhidharma, and he goes up into the mountains, and sits in the snow. And Bodhidharma rejecting him is like the worst thing that can happen. This is like the worst thing that can happen. I don't know about cutting off your arm, you know. I don't think it's a good idea. But I also think it's a mistake, you know. I'm not sure. One way to understand this koan is that by cutting off his arm, he makes a necessary sacrifice in order to be accepted. But actually, it wasn't a necessary sacrifice. You know, he thinks he has to sacrifice himself to escape from his unhappiness. You know? When really that's not the way. That's not the way. He didn't have to cut off his arm. He kept thinking, in order to be worthy of trust, I have to cut off my arm. But actually, I don't think that's true. I think actually that that was a mistake he made. And I think Bodhidharma says, no, don't you understand that that's not the way to liberation? Cutting off your arm is not going to make you any calmer. It's not going to make you any happier, any more secure. Don't you understand that? And what you really have to do is find emptiness in yourself, in your mind. And when the young man does this, his mind is released from suffering. I think this is really like the heart of the koan, you know, this business about cutting off your arm. Now, the koan isn't telling you you don't have to work hard. That's not what it's saying. But I think that when things go wrong, we tend to blame ourselves. You know, we tend to blame ourselves. And actually, we tend to take it out on ourselves. We tend to be a little too hard on ourselves. And this desire to atone is not necessarily a healthy desire. The most important thing I think in life is to be able to forgive oneself for one's mistakes. I remember years ago there was a person in our Zen group who had gone to college, and after college he had gotten into the construction industry. And he felt like he had thrown his education away because he was working construction. And his job was very difficult, you know. It was really like a dirty, messy job, and he had a lot of uncertainty. And sometimes he would have no work, you know. So if you're in the construction industry, sometimes you have a lot of jobs, and then you have no jobs. And So it was a difficult life for him, and he was quite unhappy, and he admired Glenn Webb, my second teacher. And he went to Glenn's office, and one day he actually burst into tears, and he said, "I wish I were you, and I wish I could be you. You know, you have a beautiful office, and you teach classes, and you have all these lovely ideas, and also your beautiful, artwork that you know. He was so unhappy being him. And I think we all feel this at certain times, you know, unless we're Bill Gates or something. A kind of unhappiness with who we are. And so when things don't go the way we want, we can become very angry at ourselves, you know, very upset. And it could become really like self-hatred. This is not so uncommon, you know. A distrust can turn into self-hatred. So this act of the young man cutting off his arm, I think, is not meant to say you have to make sacrifices. I think it's meant to say that there's still something wrong with him, you know. He's making a sacrifice of himself instead of letting go of himself, you know. So when Bodhidharma says, please look in your mind, you know, please look at your mind and see if you can find it. And the young man tries and he can't find it. And he encounters Mushin. This is the way out of the impasse. And indeed he's released. He's released from his pain and his fear. I understand that things can go wrong. I have experiences like that too. And I also know what it's like, you know, to have no trust, you know, to lose your trust. It's very hard to get it back. And usually when that happens, we blame ourselves, you know, generally speaking. And that's odd because, of course, we don't control all the variables. You know, we really can't control many things in our lives, even in our own behavior. This morning I had to get up and run to the bathroom. I couldn't control it. You know. It was not something I wanted to do, but I had to go. But on a deeper level also, years ago I was in a conference and I got into a cab, and a man, the man who was driving the cab was a nuclear engineer. And he said, what is this? I said, oh, it's an English professor's conference. And he said, oh, that's interesting. And he said, you know, I used to be an engineer. And I said, really? What kind of engineer? He said, nuclear. He said, but you know, he said, after they stopped building nuclear facilities in the United States, he said, I couldn't get a job. You know, I went through all this college, and I studied nuclear engineering, thinking there would be a nuclear industry. And then the Congress shut it all down. And he said, so now I'm driving a cab. Now, you know, probably in his mind, he might have gone over and over again, why did I become a nuclear engineer? If only I'd studied X, right? But you know, he couldn't have known that at the time. And so he did something which was... it turned out not to be a good move, right? Not to be a wise move. But there's no way he could have known. But I will imagine that at some point in his life, I would imagine he blamed himself, you know. And I think people would rather think of themselves as having made a bad decision than really admitting to themselves that there's a lot in life that we can't control. And so you know, this Zen practice is quite important because it's learning how to deal with a world we can't control. We can't. And I think it's also learning how not to take it personally. You know, not to take it personally. When you sit down on the cushion, you can intend to have a wonderful sit, but that doesn't mean it's going to be a wonderful sit. It might not work out that way. And you learn how to trust. You know, you keep coming here and doing Zen. And when I ask you how your sits are, sometimes they're good and sometimes they're not so good. But you keep coming. Now, it could just be an addiction, right? but it might not be. It might have to do with what you're learning. You're learning how to trust. You know, and when you don't have a good sit, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the end of the world, right? You have to trust. And if you keep practicing, even if you're not answering your koan, you know, you keep practicing, you keep practicing, you keep practicing. You're really like building up your trust in life. It's really like learning how to trust. Because you sit down on the cushion and you don't know what's going to happen, and sometimes it's not what you expected, and sometimes it's wonderful. But often it's so-so, you know, that's the truth, it's so-so. But you know, you say, I don't care if it's so-so, I'm going to give it a try anyway. And sometimes you do that and all of a sudden it turns into heaven, right? But sometimes it's nothing, you know, it doesn't work out. But nevertheless, you know, having that relationship of trust is so important. And we learn it by doing Zazen, I think. You learn how to empty the mind and wait patiently and greet what is arising with a kind of like open heart. Open heart. This is a very good training. To try to do this when you're in a situation that's difficult is the hardest thing, right? When things seem to be falling apart, if you can cultivate this open-heartedness, even in the middle of your wretchedness, you might suddenly feel like a big smile is opening up in yourself. You know, you might find this is true. It's like even in the middle of your wretchedness, you suddenly realize, my God, this is beautiful. So, trust, yes? When I was... finishing up my training at the Seattle Zen Center, what was then the Seattle Zen Center, we had some financial problems with our group. We had bought a temple property up in the mountains, and it was quite beautiful. It was really stunningly beautiful. You could see for 100 miles. And we were up on a mountain, and you could see for 100 miles, and it was dry pine country. So it wasn't like here, where the hills are all covered with trees. Large portions of the hills were covered with grasses, and there was a tree belt, you know, above that. And so, you know, when we built our temple there, it was just astonishingly beautiful. And everybody would come up and see it and take photos. But we began to have some financial problems. And we eventually lost the property and the Zendo, which is today probably like a ski resort or something. And I was in charge of the money during this period. And I have to say that it was, you know, it was quite a traumatic experience for me. I really took it seriously, personally. And when we lost the property, it really was devastating to me and a lot of people. I sometimes talk to people in our group, and some of them still can't forget this episode. Well, anyway, I realized I had to let it go. You know, I had to let it go. And trust. Very important. And it took a long time for me to trust, you know, again. You know, I kept doing Zazen, and little by little, I began to think, well, you know, things can turn out okay. That was sort of like the beginning of this group, for example. So, I hope you had a good sit this morning. And I hope things are going well in your life. And if they're not, please realize that, you know, there's a kind of rhythm to life where things are falling apart for a while and then they come back together again, and things are falling apart for a while and then they come back together again. It's important to realize nothing falls apart forever. There's always like a ground floor, you know, and then it all starts collecting. It's like things fall apart and then they reach a limit and then they start swirling back together in a different way. You know, this is how existence unfolds and folds back into itself. You know, when they're falling apart, we become terrified and we think it will never stop. Will it ever stop? But it does stop. And then, you know, we start moving in the other direction again. So at any rate, you know, remember trust, and you can't make yourself trust, but you could sit on the cushion and empty your mind, and when that happens, you'll suddenly find that you have the capacity to deal with what's happening, even if it's unpleasant or difficult. And if you're really in deep mushin, you begin to feel that you're moving along with events, basically, you're part of something larger than yourself. You know? And then you begin to feel very alive, and this sense of trust arises spontaneously. So, thank you very much for coming to practice this morning.